This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. A memorial service is being held this week in Kalamazoo for the Reverend Daniel Berrigan. The longtime activist for peace and social justice passed away earlier this year. Coming up, the co-founder of Peace House in Kalamazoo, Jerry Berrigan, remembers his uncle, father, and others in the anti-war movement. But first,
we need many things to keep and maintain the world as a better place. But nothing else will matter if we fail to protect the ocean. Our fate and the ocean are one.
In Sylvia Earle's TED Talk that won her the 2009 TED Prize, she called for action to save the living ocean while there is still time. Sylvia Earle will speak on Thursday, October 6th, at Chenery Auditorium in Kalamazoo. Her address, called Exploring the Deep Frontier, is part of the Science and the Human Endeavor series, sponsored by Western Michigan University's Center for the Humanities and Lee Honors College. Sylvia Earle, thank you very much for speaking with us.
It's great to be on board.
Explain, first of all, where your love of the ocean came from.
Very naturally, I suppose. My parents took summer vacations on the New Jersey shore. I got knocked over by a wave when I was 3 years old. The ocean literally got my attention. But what has held my attention ever since is life in the ocean. There were great craggy horseshoe crabs that would come ashore. And even at that young age, I was fascinated by them and by everything else that that moves, I suppose. I think most children are, but I was really lucky to have parents who encouraged my curiosity in critters.
Has technology made it easier to see what's happening on the ocean floor? I mean, are there things that that are possible now that perhaps early in your career, the technology just wasn't there?
Absolutely. Technology is the key, not only to exploring the skies above and seeing Earth from afar, but also diving in and seeing the blue part of the planet from the inside out. It's ironic, though, that we have sent humans far into space and have repeatedly out into Earth orbit, but only three people have been 7 miles down in the ocean. Now, 7 miles is a long way if you're holding your breath. It's not so far if you're going sideways or up in the sky, because children, everyone, anybody who flies an airplane is likely to go as much as 7 miles above. Certainly the long-distance flights take you that high in the sky. And people do it, eating lunch, watching movies, taking naps, underwater. The first descent was in 1960 by two people in a device called the bathyscaphe. And more recently, 2012, when James Cameron, best known, I suppose, for his filmmaking, Avatar, Titanic, and many others, is also an explorer. He's one of those kids who kept that curiosity and still has it all his life, always asking questions, always wondering about the next thing. And he's a great storyteller, but he's also very good at finding the truth and then build stories that can tell the truth about what's happening. But curious, isn't it, that only three people have been 7 miles down. Millions have traveled 7 miles up. The technology, we have the technology. What's I think baffling is that we have been slow to apply the technologies that would enable us to really explore the ocean.
And you have warned us in the past that the oceans are in fact dying. How close to death are the Earth's oceans as we speak?
Well, it is an exaggeration to say dying, that they are in trouble, that I think microbes are likely to survive one way or the other far into the future with us or without us. But to have a healthy, vibrant, productive ocean that shapes our life support system to hold the planet steady in ways that favor us, that's what is now in decline. And part of maybe the major concern is what we are putting into the ocean, the toxins that are new to the ocean and all of the history of the world. We've manufactured chemicals that don't exist in nature, and they wind up in the ocean one way or the other. What we put into the atmosphere goes back into the sea, and certainly the carbon dioxide that we are really putting into the atmosphere by burning fossil fuels, releasing methane as well, greenhouse gases that are warming the planet, and carbon dioxide that's going into the ocean. It's able to absorb an enormous amount of the excess CO2 in the atmosphere, but too much of a good thing. We need some carbon dioxide to drive photosynthesis, but we have put so much into the atmosphere, and what has gone into the ocean is causing the ocean to become more acid, acidifying the ocean, changing the chemistry of the ocean. There are some microbes that will think that's just fine, but those that are currently dominating the planet and generating the oxygen, taking up the carbon dioxide, creating the world that really is in our favor, they may or may not be favored by this changing chemistry. And it's certain that some of them are not favored because acidifying the ocean damages the calcium carbonate shells of some of the principal photosynthesizers, little tiny organisms called coccolithophorids, and right up the food chain, oysters and clams. It's just changing the chemistry of the ocean, changes everything. So the ocean not dying, the ocean is changing in ways not favorable to the world as we not only know it, but as we need it. We've taken things out of the ocean that also are dramatically changing the nature of the ocean. We've targeted top predators many years ago, centuries ago, taking the large fish, taking whales, taking the creatures that we use for food and for oil and for products of various sorts, but nothing has really been come close to the extraction of wildlife from the sea that really started in the middle of the 20th century, because that's when we began to use techniques that were primarily developed for combat, for war, sonar, the new materials, the plastics that are now used, lightweight, enduring materials that are used in nets, and so many things that have tipped the scales in favor of those who are extracting from the ocean. And I'm not talking just oil and gas and minerals, although that's another way that we're changing the nature of the ocean.
You mean also fishing?
But the wildlife, yes, more than 100 million tons. It's closer now. The estimates are 140 million tons, because much of what has been taken in recent decades has not been reported. It's either illegal or unreported. And new estimates suggest that there's a lot more coming out.
Now, you, of course, have seen a lot of things under the surface of the ocean that many of us don't see. Do you worry sometimes that the changes that you've witnessed are just not visible to the general public, and therefore that's part of the reason it isn't big on the radar of the average person, or maybe even the policymaker who might have a little more say over this?
There's been recent change, an uptick, an upswing, I think you could say, in terms of awareness of why the ocean matters and why the damage that we're doing has consequences that we had not taken note of, in part because from the surface, the ocean looks pretty much the same today as it did, likely did 10,000 years ago. But by not only having millions of divers into the ocean and scientific expeditions around the world that are measuring the nature of the changes, defining what our life. I mean, if you like to breathe, to listen up, because that's pretty fundamental, that the ocean shapes our life support system. And whatever you do, wherever on the planet you live, if you've never seen the ocean, if you've never touched the ocean touches you, literally, with every breath you take, every drop of water that you drink, because the ocean is where most of the water is, and because water over the ages cycles up into the sky, falls back on the land, trickles eventually back into the ocean. It's the ocean that makes our lives possible. And an ocean in decline affects everything. It's not just, oh, I'm not going to be able to eat swordfish anymore because their numbers are diminishing, or tuna, oh, their numbers are down by close to 95%, maybe more in some places. And cod, that used to be the cornerstone of the economy of nations around the North Atlantic for 500 years, they're essentially disappearing. I mean, they are in such low numbers, it's a wonder that people can find any to take at this point in time. But we are still taking them. We are still extracting tuna. We are still taking sharks out of the ocean. Although we know that 90% of the sharks now, the big ones at least, have been extracted, some species down by 99%. And the awareness that there are consequences to that is beginning to become publicly made known.
If we're going to stop and hopefully reverse the decline of the oceans, what do we actually have to do?
Well, we certainly have to look at what we're taking out of the ocean and change the policies. If we don't, the projections are that by the middle of this century, that's like 15 years or so from now, 20 years from now, there won't be commercial fishing because there really won't be enough fish left to support it. So look at what you are consuming, you, the consumer. What we take from the ocean, after all, is like bushmeat in Africa. It's wildlife, and some species are as endangered as the lions and tigers and elephants in terms of being right on the edge of either they'll be here in the next half century, or we will, through our inaction, our continued taking of them for a luxury taste or for products, we'll lose the chance to save them. So individual choices. Be careful what you do with plastics. Plastics of themselves are not dangerous. They're just things. But buying and using single-use plastics, that's a personal choice that you can make and say, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm going to be conscious that one-time-use plastic is really an excessive habit. And we need to turn things around. Be conscious. Be mindful of the impact each and every one of us is having with the choices that we're making, and to be supportive of things such as the laws that protect water, that protect air, that protect wildlife, to support the establishment of parks on the land that protect our life support system, and certainly this relatively new concept of protecting the ocean. The voice of individuals, individually and together, are really what make whatever civilization is, but that's how it happens. Individuals do something, and it takes every one of us to make those positive choices, knowing that if we don't, who will? And if we don't do it now, when will people be motivated to take those decisions? Make the world a better place.
Sylvia Earle, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me on board.
Oceanographer, explorer, and author Sylvia Earle will speak on Thursday, October 6th at Chenery Auditorium in Kalamazoo. Her address, called Exploring the Deep Frontier, is part of the Science and the Human Endeavor series, sponsored by Western Michigan University's Center for the Humanities and Lee Honors College. A link with more details can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. When the Reverend Daniel Berrigan passed away earlier this year, the author James Carroll wrote in an essay for The New Yorker that for many, many American Catholics, what it meant to be American and what it meant to be Catholic was radically altered by the witness of Daniel Berrigan. This Friday, Kalamazoo Nonviolent Opponents of War, Peace House in Kalamazoo, and St. Thomas More Catholic Student Parish are holding a memorial service for Daniel Berrigan, who died in April at the age of 94. Jerry Berrigan is one of the co-founders of Peace House. He's also the nephew of the late Reverend Daniel Berrigan. Thank you very much for being here, Jerry.
Thank you for having me, Gordon.
Let's give just a brief description, if you would, of your uncle's philosophy, along with your parents. Your father was also a priest at one time, and they worked together on many anti-Vietnam War protests. What was their basic philosophy about war and social justice in general?
Sure. And my mother, Elizabeth McAllister, was a nun before she met my father and so forth, too. So I couldn't begin to answer that question without saying that they were first and foremost Catholics who tried to take the Gospels very seriously. They were taught to do so in their homes. They went to Catholic schools. They went to church devoutly, as did everyone they knew, right? It's what you did. It is your identity, right? You're a Catholic. That was very strong for them from the cradle. And, growing up when they did, Daniel Berrigan was born in 1921, my father Philip in 1923. My father served in World War II, while my uncle Dan entered the Jesuit seminary at the age of 13 and left home. They were the youngest two of six boys, most of whom served in World War II. It was just part of the national experience, and although my father never talked about it much, he saw some horror, right? Returned from the war, and Uncle Dan counseled him to kind of make the move to join the priesthood, because there he could do something with his life. Dad was kind of foundering, and so they underwent the experience of being in seminary together, both becoming ordained, Daniel with the Society of Jesus, the Jesuits, and my father with the Society of St. Joseph, SSJ. And my father was assigned to black inner-city parishes, first in Washington, D.C., and then in New Orleans. And by the late 1950s, was absolutely convinced that American racism was sinful and wrong, anti-human, and against the will of God, right? So it was a biblical critique, a human critique, of an American institution, right?
Did then that realization about racism eventually inform his views on the Vietnam War as well as your uncle's views?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, by the early 1960s, as U.S. involvement in Vietnam was becoming more apparent, they would routinely write theological articles in which they critiqued both American racism and Vietnam, and indeed Cold War strategy at the time, which was based even then very deeply in nuclear weapons. So their critique of all of this was a biblical one. It's God's earth. We're not allowed to blow it up with nuclear weapons, right? We're not allowed to kill everyone because we have a political disagreement with the Soviet Union, right? That's wrong. It can't be allowed.
And when it came to protesting the Vietnam War, they eventually took part in what we, I guess, would call civil disobedience, acts that they knew would likely get them arrested perhaps put in jail for quite some time, as did happen. Mm-hmm. What was, as you understand it, talking to both your uncle and your father, what led them to say that they had to take that step? What made them say, yes, this is worth me getting arrested for?
There were, a number of kind of specific experiences that they've mentioned, both in speech and in writing. Certainly a progression towards that final step of civil disobedience. Conventional protest and kind of the avenues of conventional protest had been employed for years by both of them, right? Writing articles, hosting public debates, right? Inviting a member of the military to come talk Cold War strategy and just debate them and talk ideas in a public way, public legal protest. All of these routes had been explored. And to no avail, right? The war continued. At the same time, my uncle was working as a chaplain at Cornell, and he was seeing that his students were in a way riskier position than he was, right? So he's counseling students who are saying, I just got my draft card. I might have to go to war. I don't want to go to war. What do I do, right? Having those conversations. And a number of his students decided to publicly burn their draft cards in protest and thus open themselves up to, you know, a sentence of a couple of years in prison, probably. That struck Uncle Dan as somehow quite wrong, that, you know, if he believed that the war was wrong, as he did, if these young men were being forced into situations where they were looking at a couple of years in prison, and he was supposed to be following Jesus, who confronted the state in a very direct way and was executed for it, right? If he's supposed to be following Jesus, not only in word, but also in deed somehow, that some experience of suffering would be appropriate there as a gift, as a sacrament even. So I think they both very much saw it that way. And the acts of civil disobedience that they began to commit were very Catholic in nature, right? They used symbols, and we've got a very symbolic religion, right? What happens at the Eucharist is, perhaps among other things, an incredible bit of symbolism, right? So they kind of dug into that whole realm as they kind of began to really confront the war.
Catonsville was, of course, perhaps the most famous or well-covered incident of that time, where they went into an office, took draft cards out. As I understand it, the office staff kind of stood there a little dumbfounded that someone would come in and do this, and then took them outside and burned them. And your uncle's statement at that time, our apologies, good friends, for the fracture of good order, the burning of paper instead of children, kind of rings as sort of a, we understand that this was different. We understand that we probably, you know, made some people uncomfortable, but at the same time, it felt that it was necessary. Is that how you read that when you look back on it all these years later?
Yes, absolutely. It was a tremendous breach in protocol, right? And in good manners. No question about that. And, you know, here you had nine Catholics, including two priests and a Christian brother, a former priest who was recently married to a former nun who had been missionaries for the church, right? And some very respectable lay people doing a deed like this, you know, to go into an office, to take their files with no announcing, right? And to burn hundreds of draft files in the parking lot. So it's a fracture of good order, right? He kind of nailed it that way. And yet, that action had a real effect, right? Those were the only copies of those files. Nothing was backed up. And hundreds of young men throughout the Baltimore area were then put into the place where they could either not go or, you know, go back down to the draft board and say, here I am, because they wanted to or whatever, right? It put the choice back in the hands of the young men, right? And the symbolism there, right, of burning them with napalm as opposed to something else, it's kind of one or the other, right? What's the war about? What's happening over there? So that's what really grabbed the imagination of the country, you know? I grew up in Baltimore. When I was in middle school, my best friend's dad, who didn't agree with us politically at all, shared that he was put in a position to not have to go to Vietnam because of that action. He was grateful for that. He didn't want to go. He didn't go.
Since you mentioned there both your uncle and your father being Catholic priests, we should note, obviously, your father left the priesthood, or we wouldn't be having this conversation.
That's right. Yeah. And
I'm just wondering if there was a difference in who they were as people, your Uncle Daniel and your father, Philip, if there was some sort of difference there that kept your uncle in the priesthood, or was it just life circumstance?
Well, I mean, I think my parents just fell in love, right? They were an incredible pair for their entire married life. And inseparable. I can't imagine the one without the other, as it turns out, right? And that was more powerful for both my mother and my father than the vows that they had already made, you know? So, I mean, when it happened, it took a little while for the dust to settle, but when it did, the major relationships remained very much intact. And, you know, my uncle welcomed the three of us into the world and baptized all of us, and, you know, it continued on from there. I think by temperament, Uncle Dan was very much a priest, and his primary relationship was with God, you know. And I can't imagine it having gone any other way, really.
So I want to read this quote that's in the New York Times obituary for your uncle, the Reverend Daniel Berrigan, from 2001, when he said, "The day after I'm embalmed," and this was on his 80th birthday, "that's when I'll give it up." Is that how this turned out, that he was still involved as long as he could be in social justice and the issues of the day as he saw them?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, his death followed a period of, you know, extended frailty, right? So it became clear that, you know, physically he was not able to go to this event, or, you know, it's just the world closes in. And it did that for Uncle Dan, right? He spent his final years at a Jesuit retirement community in the Bronx next to Fordham University. It was kind of like a care facility that went all the way up to extended care, right? And so that was, you know, it just got smaller. And yet, I mean, he remained convinced in his heart that work for peace was absolutely necessary. He enjoyed a lot of visitors. People would come in and say, "I've just been doing this, I've just been doing that." We just had a vigil in Times Square in front of the recruiting office on the anniversary of Hiroshima, right? And he would say, thank you for doing that, you know. Yeah, there was no change in his convictions at all.
Is Peace House a continuation of your family's belief in social justice, anti-war, et cetera?
Well, yeah, it's very different. It's very different. I mean, I grew up in a community that was dedicated to the resistance of war and nuclear weapons. We were routinely going to demonstrations at the Pentagon and the White House an hour away from where we lived. And the people who lived in the community were constantly in and out of jail and prison, right, for acts of civil disobedience. And it was an incredible way to grow up. It was pretty intense, too, right? So we're making some different choices for our families than my parents made for ours. You know, my mother is still alive, and she affirms every one of them, right? I think it's possible I've gone a little bit soft. But
you're,
you know,
not in jail?
Because I'm not, you know. Well, because, you know, because the challenge that they laid out was for all of us, right, to say, you know, what more can we do? There's always more to do, right? We live in very dangerous times, I think. And even if the election swings the way I hope it swings, we're going to continue to live in very dangerous times, because we remain in a permanent war economy. The United States is an empire. We're bent on taking other people's stuff by force, consuming more than we deserve on a global scale. These are kind of deeply moral problems, right, and need to be for us. So, you know, to keep one's life in perspective with all of that, I think is kind of the ultimate lesson that I take from my father and mother and uncle. And it's a daily challenge.
Jerry Berrigan, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Gordon.
Jerry Berrigan is the co-founder of Peace House in Kalamazoo. Jerry's uncle, Reverend Daniel Berrigan, passed away in April. Peace House, Kalamazoo Nonviolent Opponents of War, and St. Thomas More Catholic Church are holding a memorial service for Daniel Berrigan on Friday. You can find a link with more details at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.